On my right inner forearm, I have tattooed Sekhmet. Sekhmet is the Egyptian goddess of sex and retribution. On my left arm, I have the name of a street that's become an icon of our revolution, Mohammed Mahmoud, and the Arabic word for freedom, Hurriya. I got those tattoos in 2012 and 2013 because they symbolized the day that I became a number, the day I joined the ranks of the hundreds of women who've been sexually assaulted since the revolution in Egypt began. My name is Mona Al-Tahawi, and I'm a writer and activist. The 2011 uprisings united people across the region in demanding greater freedoms and in saying we have a right to express ourselves and to say no. But what happened after the protests? In some countries, women were pushed off the streets and told to go home. In some instances, they were forcibly silenced. In this two-part series for the BBC World Service, I'm going to introduce you to women from Jordan, Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. If we're ever to stand a chance of finishing what we started in the revolutions, what these women say and do must matter. These are the women of the Arab Spring.
Events have moved dramatically and alarmingly in the capital, Tunis.
At the end of a dramatic day here in Tunisia, President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali fled with his family.
And when you read the constitution, it's who we are. I mean, gender equality, when we decided to vote for it, it's also who we are, because even if we had some concerns about, but finally, we are a country where we think about equality.
It was as if something had been unleashed. Thousands of people took to the streets of Cairo, the biggest challenge to the government in years.
After the revolution, we were belittled. When women were harassed, they started saying, why did they go there at the very first place? What? We are there to defend our countries. Why would men be out there in the Tahrir Square and other squares in Egypt? And why? We are not supposed to do that. Does that mean that I do belong in my home just to serve men when they come back with a triumph?
Celebrations continued overnight across Libya following the death of Colonel Gaddafi.
Well, this is the place where they captured Colonel Gaddafi, a drainage tunnel underneath the road on the outskirts.
In Libya, on 15th of February 2011, women literally initiated the revolution in front of the police station. There was no men who dared to come out and protest.
This was the moment Tunisian politicians put aside their differences, passing a new historic constitution. 3 years on from the revolution, it's been a long and emotional road to democracy.
Tunisia was the first country to topple its dictator off the back of demonstrations that began in December 2010. In Egypt, we were shocked. How was it that small, progressive, seemingly peaceful Tunisia had managed to do this? Since then, we've continued to be shocked. In 2 years, whilst Egypt's had three different regimes and two constitutions, Tunisia's first free and elected constituent assembly has taken its time to write its own. Amira Yahyawi works for the organization Al-Bawsala, an NGO which monitors the parliament and oversaw the drafting of the constitution. It's the first of its kind in the Arab world. Amira was also instrumental in the introduction of another regional precedent, an article guaranteeing gender equality. On Tunisia's Independence Day, in her office, overlooking the Mohammed Habib Bourguiba Avenue, she tells me how they did it.
We said, everyone who will vote against it, we will put your picture on Avenue Habib Bourguiba and everyone will see you. It's not going to be hidden at all.
Amira examined 150 constitutions to come up with the best possible one for her country. And she's confident that the end result is one which reflects all Tunisians.
Tunisia has been under a dictatorship forever. And so for the first time in our history, we decided just to answer who we are. It was Tunisia in that assembly. It wasn't the elite at all. We had the elite, but we have the 80% who are not. I mean, gender equality, when we decided to vote for it, it's also who we are, because even if we had some concerns about, but finally, we are a country where we think about equality.
Under Ben Ali's regime, political Islam was banned. Islamists, men and women, were jailed and tortured for their beliefs, women forbidden to wear the hijab in public places. But after the revolution, like in Egypt and Libya, Tunisia voted in an Islamic party, and so the parliamentarians overseeing the constitution came from all ideological hues, some secular, some moderate Islamic, some fundamentalist. There were outside concerns that an Islamic majority would never vote in such a progressive constitution, but even the most extreme member, who was not used to working with women, especially one not wearing a headscarf, was eventually won over.
I was talking to him to get his bio, and it was during the winter, and I was, completely dressed. And he looked at me and he said, "I don't talk to naked women." I said, "What? Naked? I'm not naked. Do you want me to show you what is naked?" And I started taking off my clothes. He was shocked seeing me in the assembly. I take off my coat, and then I was opening my dress. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm showing you what means naked." And it was funny because when we voted the constitution, he said he was against the constitution in his speech the last day. And then I voted for it. I was happy seeing him voting for it. I took him and I hugged him. And I think it was the first time he hugged someone else than his wife.
We're standing on Mohamed Bourguiba Avenue in Tunis. And passing by are several young men and women, many of them holding hands, some with their arms around each other. That in and of itself makes it very different to Cairo, this veneer of liberalism. But that's what we've come to ask. Is it just a veneer, or is Tunisia, as many of us in the region often thought, much more progressive than other countries? Now that Tunisia has just passed a constitution that is the first in the region to enshrine equality between men and women, is it really going to have an impact on women's lives? Are women's lives going to be better now after the revolution? Or is it just something on a piece of paper and it remains to be seen whether it will be implemented in real life or not?
When people took to the streets like December 2010, 2011, yeah, it's true that they were calling for employment, for freedom and for dignity. I think that they weren't really ready to accept that freedom means all freedoms, including women freedoms, sexual freedoms, all individual freedoms. So, yeah, they are not ready for such a revolution.
A linguistics teacher at Tunis University, 30-year-old Lina blogs under the name Tunisian Girl. She was active in the revolution, and where we're sitting on this street is extremely significant to her. She can see the Ministry of Interior where her father was tortured under the Ben Ali regime. Lina has also suffered for her activism. For the last 6 months, she's had round-the-clock police protection because her name was found on an assassination list of a well-known fundamentalist group.
I kept on denouncing the several governments, and because I'm talking about terrorism, about extremism, because I'm defending women's rights, because I'm a secular person and I strongly believe that we don't have to mix religion and politics, and this is why I'm targeted by those people.
If we can compare the way, say, women look today in this coffee shop and other coffee shops with the way they looked before, what would you say has changed the most for the women?
Under the regime of Ben Ali, women were not allowed to wear the veil. So it was really rare to see a woman with a hijab or a niqab or a burqa or whatever. Now we can see those women.
How do you feel about that as a secular Tunisian woman? Is it something that you're upset about, or is it something that you celebrate as part of freedom?
I consider this as a personal freedom. I know that under the regime of Ben Ali, many women used to be arrested, and even some of them were beaten by the police just because wearing a veil. I have an aunt who wears the hijab, and she had been arrested several times. She's not an extremist, and she's wearing it just because she wants to wear it. It's a personal freedom, but those people don't have to interfere with my personal freedom.
I mean, I hear of, you know, university professors being yelled at by their students. We heard of one incident of an art gallery that was broken into and attacked by Salafists. And you know, you hear about this stuff in the news, but you live here. So do you feel it is impacting your day-to-day life, or is this an exaggeration?
I don't think that it is an exaggeration. It happened so many times. Last year, I remember that one of my female students, she said that her roommate were trying to force her to wear the niqab, yeah. And she was wearing black clothes and the veil, almost the burqa. And she said, I didn't used to wear this thing, and now they forced me to do so.
We're in Tadamon neighborhood, which is one of the biggest working class neighborhoods in the continent of Africa. And we've come here to meet Fatima Jrem, who is a women's rights activist who set up an association called Challenge in Tadamon neighborhood to teach boys and girls and young men and women graffiti, rap, theater, dance, to teach them things that the revolution basically came about to empower them with. There's a clause in the constitution that guarantees equality between men and women. Will that have an actual impact on girls and boys and men and women in this neighborhood?
Equality is a practice. It's not just about words. It's not just about having a nice clause in a constitution. Women are fighting many different types of extremism, economic extremism, cultural extremism, and various forms of violence. The real difference will come when I feel safe everywhere I go. If I stand here in the street, do you really respect me as a woman? Can you guarantee my safety?
19-year-old Aya and her mother Nejma live in a Tadamon, and Aya attends the arts organization set up by Fatma. Aya wears a headscarf whilst her mother, who's a hairdresser, does not. I asked Aya what she thinks about the gender clause.
I like this clothes because before, the man always ran everything. The man was always the priority, and the main role for girls and women was in the home. But now, I feel this clothes gives girls and women more rights to be out there and the right to live.
If you could change one thing about the lives of girls and women in this neighborhood, what would it be?
The one thing I would change is the mentality. Because the neighbors all the time say, how could you let your daughter go to the association? It's full of boys. And I say, you know, it's none of your business. This is my daughter. She likes to go here, so I let her go.
I asked Nejma what impact in the neighborhood the growing presence of Islamic fundamentalists, emboldened since the overthrow of Ben Ali, is having on her life.
I'm worried about the fundamentalist and extremist groups, and especially concerned when I come home late from work. Sometimes I leave deliberately early, so I won't run into them. We know our religion. I understand what my religion is about, and I understand that wearing a hijab is a personal choice. Sometimes I have clients who come to the salon wearing hijab and take it off inside because they are worried that men outside who are Salafi or from other fundamentalist groups will look at them badly or force them to put it on.
But for the time being at least, the future of Tunisia is not in the hands of Salafis, but the elected men and women of the Constituent Assembly, the majority of which do belong to an Islamist party, but not an ultra-conservative one. I'm sitting in a traditional Tunisian coffee shop in a resort called Kantawi, near the tourist town of Sousse. And I'm here to meet politician Fatoum Laswad, who belongs to a Nahda movement. And she was elected in October of 2011 to be a member of her country's constituent assembly. And she was one of the many women who pushed for the clause on gender equality in the constitution. On the day when you passed the wording on gender equality, how did you feel?
It was a wonderful feeling of victory, especially because many of the women in the Constituent Assembly were from the Ennahda movement, and people had a very negative opinion of them. They thought that because these were women wearing hijab, that they don't believe in women's rights, they don't believe in equality. But we were able to give an example to the whole world of how to work together for gender equality.
Is there a red line for you where you just feel that you cannot push for women's rights and that you must step back?
No, there might be some groups in Tunisia who would recoil at the idea of total equality, especially when it comes to inheritance. But what was most important to us, and we managed to achieve this, is that we managed to establish that a woman as a citizen was equal to a man as a citizen. And this is a big deal to the Arab world, because the Arab world is very patriarchal, and men are always placed above women. So the biggest challenge was to say no, men and women are equal as citizens in the constitution.
The lack of any legislation in the new constitution on the old personal status laws, inheritance rights, rights for women to pass on their nationality or to travel alone with their children, was criticized heavily. These are patriarchal rights that traditional Arab societies will not relinquish easily. But for Amira Yahyawi, with gender equality enshrined, the genie is firmly out of the bottle.
When we wanted to vote for gender equality, that was the biggest question. We're putting gender equality in the constitution. These people will ask for equality in inheritance, of course. And we will, of course. And so it was really interesting because, I mean, they were fearing it. And together we decided, without a real consent, we decided not to talk about it. We decided we just want gender equality. What is gender equality? Is men and women equal in what? Everything. But if you ask me the question, if tomorrow Tunisian people will decide to use equality and inheritance, I would say, of course not. We need time where both of them are possible. So it becomes more and more a habit.
Within the past few minutes, it's been announced that King Abdullah of Jordan has sacked his Prime Minister, Samir Rifai, and appointed a replacement, Maruf Bakhit, with an order for him to carry out political reform. It follows demonstrations against poverty, unemployment, and what protesters say is a lack of political freedom in the country.
I'm Mona El-Tahawi, and if you've just tuned in, you're listening to the voices of the women of the Arab Spring on the BBC World Service. Now, not all Arab countries felt the full force of the revolutions that happened in Tunisia and elsewhere, but ripples were felt across the entire region, including in Jordan. Here, the protests started about the economy, but women's groups, spurred by watching their neighbours in the Arab world speak out, soon came onto the streets to protest about child marriage laws, so-called honour killings, and domestic violence. Political reform brought in a 12% quota for women, and there are now 18 women in parliament. Wafa bin Mustafa heads up a campaign in the Jordanian parliament to abolish Article 308, a law which allows a rapist to escape punishment by marrying his victim. Earlier this year, activists in Morocco succeeded in having their equivalent law abolished after a 16-year-old who was forced to marry her rapist committed suicide. But are Jordanian women sufficiently empowered to do the same?
It won't be surprising if I say to you that every woman member of parliament attended the session of signing the petition and none of them opposed it. And this indicates that more women in parliament will naturally lead to there being better laws for women outside of parliament. 22 members of parliament have signed the petition to cancel this law. But it is difficult to do so because there are various legislators and jurists and men in the parliament, really, who think that this article preserves the structure of Jordanian society and protects the social fabric.
But it doesn't protect its girls and women from the men who rape them. In fact, in many cases, it does the exact opposite.
This is a picture of the wedding party. And this is a picture of me and Mohammed. This is a picture of the two of us, too. That's me and him dancing. This is my picture of me and him and my mom. That's me and him and my aunt. That's me and him and my sister. These are our pictures. Maybe these should be the best time of your life, but I was scared about what would happen after.
2 years ago, when she was just 16, Dalal was kidnapped, raped, and held against her will for 5 days.
I cried out. I wanted to leave. And he hit me. Hits me on my head. And there were marks on my body. The family protection unit took pictures of them for the medical reports. 5 days I stayed there, then I escaped from him. The judge's sentence was 23 years for rape and kidnapping, and for giving me drugs, and for using weapons on me. The judge decided that he couldn't get out of it unless I agreed to get engaged to him. I said no, I don't want to marry him. And so the judge gave him 23 years, but he said to him, if you get engaged, you'll get off.
After pressure from her own parents and her rapist parents, Dalal agreed to get married.
When I married him, it's like he was raping me again, because I didn't want him. I didn't want to get married. And he raped me, and he hit me, and burnt me with cigarettes. And his parents, they would encourage him to do these things.
After 2.5 months, Dalal left her husband and returned to her parents. She is now pregnant by him, but they're getting a divorce.
Girls like me, their position in society is difficult, from their parents and other people. I'm against the idea that someone who is raped then gets married to her rapist. But the girl doesn't have any other option, because she'll be forever ostracized by all of society.
According to this article, the Attorney General has the jurisdiction to re-trial him if he divorces the victim within 3 years for some crimes and 5 years in other crimes. But in practice, if this such divorce happens, nobody tells the Attorney General. There is no mechanism for the Attorney General to follow up if he divorces the victim of the rape.
Eva Abu Halawi is a lawyer and co-founder of the Mizan Human Rights Organization, which represents Dalal. She's worked on many cases of teenage girls marrying their rapists. The law states that couples who marry under Article 308 should stay together for a minimum of 3 years before getting a divorce. Otherwise, the man has to face the penalty for his crime. In theory, this is to prevent men from simply escaping punishment. But does this work in practice?
What's happened in practice was not a very real marriage, because the woman will wasn't taken in consideration. Usually there is pressure from the family, and sometimes they receive money. Usually it's with a high dowry, and you know, some people think it's for the benefit of the woman, while usually she doesn't benefit.
We've heard some people say women who are raped have the choice, basically two false choices now. Mm-hmm. Either to save your life from a so-called honor crime, mm-hmm. you agree to marry your rapist. Mm-hmm. And if you don't agree to marry your rapist, you could face very potential life-threatening crimes from your own family.
Yes, there is a connection between women who are in protective custody or to a juvenile center for her own protection, because the family are very upset and they intended to kill the victim.
It's hard to know how many cases there are of girls and women marrying their rapists in Jordan, because the article isn't referred to in the legal marriage contract. To further complicate matters, sometimes the law is invoked by girls under the legal marrying age, which is 18, when they want to marry their boyfriend and their families refuse, or if women are found to be having sex outside of marriage and the family want to hush it up.
Maybe the whole chapter of rape and definition of rape in the Jordanian Penal Code should be debated again.
To connect what you're saying to the revolutions that have been happening in the region, because I think if there's one thing we should be discussing is women's will and women's choice. So what for you is revolution, and how have the revolutions in the region affected women in Jordan?
For me, revolution doesn't mean just changing the political regimes and political leaders. It's about changing mentalities, which we doesn't face now in Arab world. In the contrary, it's changing mentalities to the worst.
What do you say to people when you say we must work on women's rights now, and so many people say this is not the time, we have to wait, this is not a priority, can't you see all the other problems we have? How do you answer that?
I believe it's the most priority is women's rights, because it reflects our values. And if we don't respect each other, we cannot live together. Then we will have these conflicts. If you look at any Arab community, including the Jordanian community, you can find women everywhere. You think they are very free. They don't have the right to take a decision.
But is Jordanian society ready to include women in the decision-making? Or will those in power continue to make decisions on their behalf, supposedly in their own interests? Abdelmenem Odat is head of the legal committee in the Jordanian parliament. he outlined to me the reasons why Article 308 is still relevant.
The reason we do not punish the crime is in order to protect the family, the girl in general, her parents and her reputation. Because when the girl gets married, the social impact of the crime disappears.
If somebody in the Jordanian parliament suggested changing or amending Article 308, would you support such a change?
We would have to look at the studies and statistics that exist on the subject and the legal and religious view on the subject. Legislation is a social need which expresses the wishes of a particular society and regulates the relationship of the individuals amongst them. It springs from the traditions, customs and beliefs which prevail in that society. The law cannot be separate from these things.
But there are no reliable statistics because talking about rape is still taboo in Jordanian society. Most women do not report it, and activists even think it may be underreported due to women's fear they will be forced to marry their rapists. Article 308 is a law that exists as a band-aid to cover up a conversation that Jordan desperately needs to have. A conversation about sexual freedom, shame, and honor. And legislators should set the example, not follow it. In the meantime, as Dalal's mother has come to realize, Jordan continues to reward rapists while punishing their victims.
I regret the day I helped him get off the 23-year sentence, because him and boys like him think she'll marry me and I'll get off the punishment. He robbed her of her treasure. She can never get that back. It won't be like it was for her before this happened. This raping and marrying the victim is wrong.
Join me next week for part two of Women of the Arab Spring, when I'll be asking if the revolution has reached the homes of the girls and women of Egypt. The